Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is mixer, producer, and mastering engineer Mike Cave. First of all, if you're not part of the MLC and you're a songwriter, well, then what are you waiting for? Actually, you have to be if you want to get paid at least mechanical royalties. So what is the MLC? It's the Mechanical Licensing Collective. It's a nonprofit, and it was actually created under the auspices of the Music Modernization Act. It's only there for one reason, to administer blanket mechanical licenses for digital media, but only one kind of digital media, interactive streaming, which means Spotify, which means Apple Music, which means Deezer, and any streaming network like that that's interactive. Now, this organization is going to collect the money on mechanical licenses and then distribute it to publishers and songwriters. The whole thing is, if you're not registered, you don't get paid. So a couple things have to happen. You have to register, and you have to register all your works so they can actually be matched to what's being played. If there's no match, you don't get paid. The good thing about this is you should get paid every month once it gets going, and it is going already. As of January 1st, the first bunch of royalties went out. There's only about 4,000 songwriters so far. Now, again, you don't have to worry about this if you're signed to a publisher, because the publisher is going to take care of this. But if you're an independent songwriter, this is something that you want to do. Now, don't forget, there are actually several different royalties for streaming. In this case, for interactive streams, there are three. There's the sound recording itself, which is what you're going to get paid on if you're an artist. But for songwriting, there's actually two different revenue streams. One is called performance, and the other is mechanical. So the MLC only collects mechanical royalties. That's all. And it only collects, one more time, on interactive services. Non-interactive services like Pandora or SiriusXM, nope, they don't take care of that. The MLC is not without controversy. For one thing, it's paid for by all the streaming networks. So nothing comes out of your royalties. That's a good thing. But the streaming networks are actually paying for it to be in existence. That being said, it was a law that actually put it into existence. So in a way, it's a government agency. Now, once again, if you want to get paid, you have to go and register your works. Where do you go? You go to themlc.com. That's THEMLC, all one word, themlc.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my Music Mixing Primer and 101 Mixing Tricks programs. They'll help you take your mixes to the next level. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now, I thought I'd spend a little bit of time on LUFS today. What are LUFS? Well, loudness units relative to full scale, LUFS. There's a lot of misunderstanding about this, but you should understand, first of all, that it's a measurement of audio loudness. But it's actually two things. It's a combination of human perception and the electrical signal intensity. This was designed mostly because of movies and television, and more television than anything else. The reason why, there was a time, you probably don't remember if you're fairly young, that commercials were so much louder than the regular program. They'd be blasting you out of your seat. And as a result of all the complaints that happened, the FCC actually passed a law that said, okay, from now on, you have to comply with this brand new LUFS measurement. Now, there's actually three measurements involved here. There's one that's called integrated. And what this measures is one level for the entire program. So in other words, if your program is 30 minutes long, it measures the average of that 30 minutes. If you're only talking about a 3-minute song, well, that's what it measures, that 3-minute song. This is the measurement that we're usually concerned with. There's also two other ones. There's one called short term, which measures only the last 3 seconds. And then there's another one called momentary that measures pretty much like a peak meter. So it's looking right now within about 400 microseconds of the signal intensity. Now, here's the thing. Everybody kind of knows that the lust level for Spotify and for many of the streaming networks is minus 14. And for Apple Music, it's minus 16. So they try to mix for that level. But here's the thing. It doesn't matter what level you mix to. In other words, lust doesn't really matter because no matter what you send in, they're going to re-encode it to their particular level. So even though Apple Music is minus 16, you can send something in at minus 16, they'll re-encode it anyway, so it just doesn't matter. You don't see mastering engineers worrying about this at all, and that kind of gives you an indication that you shouldn't either. Just get the best level that works for you and use that. However, if you're delivering to a television network or for a podcast, then there's probably delivery specs that you'll get that will map out exactly the level that they want. The bigger thing to worry about when it comes to music is dynamic range. The more dynamic range you have, the better off. So what happens here with lufts, it gives you an idea of dynamic range, but relative to what the 0 dB full scale is. That being said, it's also a good indication of your dynamic range. The less dynamic range you have, the worse it sounds on streaming. And the more you have, the better it's going to sound. So for instance, if your master is at minus 6 lufs, it's probably going to sound pretty bad streaming. Might sound good in the radio, but on streaming, not so much. If it's minus 12 or minus 14, I think you'll find you're going to like it a lot better, and so will your listeners. So there's a lot of misconception. There's a lot of mystery around lufs. But it's not really anything that you have to concern yourself with unless you're delivering for broadcast. Just deliver the best mix you can at a level that works for you. My guest this week is Mike Cave, who's a multi-platinum award-winning record producer, mixer, and mastering engineer. Over the course of his career, Mike has worked with artists as diverse as Elvis Costello, KRS-One, Louis Capaldi, Fatboy Slim, Bob Dylan, Echo and the Bunnymen, and many more on award-winning and record-breaking releases. He's also the owner of Loft Mastering, a high-end mastering facility based in Liverpool. During our interview, we talked about getting into mastering, mastering while mixing, becoming a project finisher, his plug-in strategy, and a whole lot more. I spoke with Mike via Zoom from his studio in Liverpool. I want to go back to when you started. You were originally a player in a band, right? You were a drummer, right?
Yeah. Do you know what was funny? I had a quick look on your website before and I realized that you signed to Polygram years ago.
Yeah.
And I did as well. It was actually Mercury Records at the time, but it was under Polygram, under that banner. So that would have been like back in 96, maybe 95, 96.
Well, it was the 80s for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, Polygram's, yeah, that was their time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, I've had that experience, which to be fair was great. It didn't, I mean, we got dropped in the end, but I mean, that was a really invaluable experience for me, that, because you know that question that people have when they come into the industry of like, what exactly does a producer do again? It's like, and obviously there's 100 answers to that, and that just being able to watch, as an artist, you know, really good producers working. That was, and at that time there was no other way to get in the room unless you're a T-boy or something.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have been party to watching the process, you know? So, that was really invaluable. And I think we were with Mercury Records for about 4 years. So, you know, it took way too long to make the records. It was badly A&R'd, but we still had a really good learning experience from it.
Did you go right into the studio when you were finished with that?
Well, to be fair, I was already, I was a very early adopter of Pro Tools. So I already had a little Pro Tools rig of my own and I was doing a lot of the programming for the band. So I was quite involved in the actual process of making the records as an artist. Not so much engineering, but doing a lot of programming. And like most of the sessions, I was actually set up in another room with my little Pro Tools rig and we were passing stuff back and forward to tape and, so I was already sort of doing a little bit of engineering back then. And then I was fishing around for assistant jobs in studios at the same time as working in the band. So by the time the band finished up, I was already at Par Street Studios in Liverpool, which was, was and still is a great facility. We were really lucky to have that here. I guess back in the day then, it was the biggest studio outside of London in the UK. We had a really great SSL room and a great Neve VR room. And we had a little mastering room, which is where I started learning about mastering. And a little demo room where we were doing a lot of the up-and-coming bands. We were just coming. And I learned how to work really fast in those sessions because, we were doing like an EP in a day or a couple of days, crazy stuff. So, and funnily enough, some of those records were the most exciting records that, I was working on because we didn't have time to like second guess them. We were just throwing them together. Whatever felt good was good, So that was a good learning curve as well. It's a great place to be, Par Street. And it's still going now and they're still busy. So it says a lot about the place,
When you decided to open your own studio, did you have mastering in mind right away?
No. My first experience getting into, I wouldn't even call it mastering at this stage, but it was in Par Street. They had like what we call an editing room, and they had the first sound tool system, which was just a two-track digital editing system. So, and one of the engineers who had been there a little bit longer than me showed me sound tools. So what we were doing, we were only really using that room for like stereo edits and just, we had, do you remember the TC Finalizer, which was, looking back now, it was bloody terrible, but that was, it probably started the loudness wars actually, that machine. but we had one of those and sound tools and a couple of DAT machines. So that was my first introduction into sort of, let's call it post-mixing. And then what I was doing then was all the records that that I was involved with, either producing or mixing or engineering, someone would have to take the tapes down to London for whoever was cutting it. So I'd always vote. I'd be like, I'll take the tapes. And then I just used to sit on as many mastering sessions as I could and just ask a lot of questions and be mildly annoying when they're trying to work. And that was how I got into mastering. But it was very much like, I wasn't confident with it at that time. It was very much like a black art back then. They didn't used to share a lot of information, as you know. And there was one session that I did that I used to always take what I call mock masters with us. I mean, it's quite common to do now, but back then, not many people were doing this where you just have a limited version that everyone had been listening to. And I used to take that down and say, okay, this is what has been approved. Can you just better that, basically? And there was one session that I did, and the guy said, he turned around and said to me, you know what? This is pretty good. I don't know if I can better this. And I really trusted that guy. And, I was taking a lot of stuff to him at the time. And that was the moment where the penny dropped and thought, you know what, maybe I could be just doing this myself. So that gave me the confidence then to start doing a lot of mastering myself. And I set up Loft Mastering, and that was about 15 years ago now. So, and that's been really busy ever since. And we've gone from, I was a very early adopter of STEM mastering as well, before anyone was really, I mean, a lot of the mastering engineers were really frowning on it at the time. Maybe that's because they didn't really understand it. They were just used to stereo or whatever. But I was doing a lot of mixing at the time. So for me, it just felt like part of the process, you know. But I think what the key change in the industry that I noticed is that people were making records in a different way. You know, people started making records in their bedrooms and not necessarily with skilled engineers and great mixers. So we've ended up in a situation now where people are delivering records that are delivering records for mastering that are very vibey, but sonically just not sounding like a record. And it's like, well, okay, you've got a couple of options here. We can either go and get a mixer and remix it, which isn't always ideal, because sometimes you can just lose a bit of the magic, or we can take the STEM mastering route. And this is often, I'm doing so much of it nowadays, and it's a solution for those projects that are almost like 80% projects, and they're like, the vibe's great, but they just don't sound like records.
Yeah.
And it's like, you try and do this, something with the stereo version, and you're just compromising things. So the stem mastering route's brilliant for that, for those type of situations, I think, where you can really take things, you know, onto a whole new level just from stems and keep the magic that was in the mix. So yeah, I was an early adopter of that, and I was just started pinching a lot of work off the big heavyweight mastering guys, really, on that basis, and grew it from there, you know.
A couple of things. First of all, it seems like you're a finisher more than a mastering engineer. Well, you're doing both, but you're going beyond mastering, really.
Yeah. I mean, that's very much how I've pitched to the UK labels, as a finisher of records, because there's a lot of great producers out there that are not very good finishers. So I work really well with those guys where, you know, they get it to a certain point, but it's almost like they hit a wall. And then, you know what it's like with you. We're only human at the end of the day, and we lose our perspective with things. We all do it. So, you know, I'm working with producers who've spent a month in a room on a record, and they just need some sort of input to finish it, you know, from a fresh pair of ears that they trust. So a lot of my work, and if you look at my discography, a lot of it's like additional production, mixing and mastering. I think over the years, even though I've done a lot of production work in the past, I've just gravitated towards finishing records because I just think it just suits me, and I just feel comfortable doing it. People are happy with the results, and I just think if you try and do too much, you just dilute what you do. I think, you know, if you try and be great at everything, so I've just found that that's what I do. That's what I do well, and you know, I'm sticking to it.
I ask this of every mastering engineer, and I'm always surprised at the answer I get. When did you get to the point where you felt in mastering now, okay, I got this. I'm not questioning myself. I'm pretty confident in whatever you give me, I'm going to make it better.
I've always said this, that trying to explain mastering to people, because to some people it is still a dark art, you know, they're not quite sure what goes on. And I try and simplify it as much as possible. And to be fair, I can do it in one word, and it's translation. That to me is everything. So I think to answer that question, when I started hearing records that I'd mastered out in lots of different environments, and it sounding great, and people enjoying them, and I guess being moved by, that's what music's all about to me, is like, can you drag as much emotion out of a record and as much drama as possible? And when I'm out in the car or in a club and you're hearing records that you've mastered and they move me, that's to me is like a big tick. It's like, okay, this works in the real world. So I think that's what gave me the confidence when I started hearing records out that I'd mastered, and they were sounding great. So I was happy, you know, and feedback from clients as well. You know, if the clients are happy, I'm happy.
Yeah. I'm curious about when you're mastering, what do you find to be the biggest problem when you're getting a mix in? Is there one thing that keeps on popping up?
I think it's harshness. And don't get me wrong, it's not all the time, but I think because digital audio is just so unforgiving, it's like whatever you put into it, the same thing comes back out. When you've got, and particularly with a lot of these sort of, as I was saying before about people making records in their bedrooms, that a lot of them are using like cheap Chinese condenser mics, and they're hyping the high mids. So when you start layering lots and lots of, like when you're multi-tracking with those type of microphones into digital, it's inevitable that you're going to get that harshness. So I always think like that's one of the key things that I'm always coming across with a lot of these records that people are making in sort of less than ideal environments, that harshness. So, you know, I want to be able to crank a record up and really still enjoy it. You know, do you hear those records where you turn them up and it's like just a little bit uncomfortable?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one of my sort of quality control tests, let's say, is like, can I just crank this up and still really enjoy it? But thankfully, we've got some amazing tools nowadays that we can resolve those issues with, you know, thankfully.
What's interesting, Mike, is that you mentioned the tools, and anybody can get them for the most part. I mean, there are some that are just, you know, mastering engineers know about and they have, but there's a lot of good tools that are really powerful. And I think in a way too powerful, because what ends up happening is if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to make it worse instead of better.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is, you just hit the nail on the head where you said powerful. They're so powerful that you can really ruin a project with them because they do so much. And if you take something like Isotope's Ozone, let's say, is a good example of this, where it's a brilliant plugin. I love Isotope, and their plugins are amazing. The problem we've got with something like Ozone is that it does so much and it's so powerful that there's a tendency for, you know, when it's used in the wrong hands, for people to do too much. And it's just as important, particularly at the mastering stage, to know when to do very little, when to be hands off. And that's just as important as when to roll your sleeves up and start digging into something. So I think that's where these tools are, when they're misused, they're so easy to misuse. That's where people are coming up against problems with them.
You know, when I started to write books, I started to I was always the same way, where I would go in all the mastering sessions, no matter what, and sit and watch. But eventually I became friends with most of the major mastering engineers and some of the minor ones, and would go hang with them. And I still do today. I'm close. I can walk to two major ones right up the street.
Yeah, brilliant.
But I also had an office for 4 or 5 years in Oasis Mastering. So every day I would sit in on them with the mastering engineers if it was unattended. And one of the things that jumped out at me always was how little they were doing, or it seemed like they were doing, and yet how big a difference it would make.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's exactly the key, isn't it, of knowing. And it's sometimes difficult to do because, you know, you want to, there's a tendency to, when a project comes in, you want to send something back that blows them away. So it's like, if you're not careful, there's a tendency of being too keen to make a difference. Whereas actually some projects come in and they don't really need a lot of work. So that they're the examples of like where it's important to know when to not do something and protect what's there. And okay, it might not be massively different than what was sent in, but it's the right thing to do. So I think that's something that I learned quite early on, is don't do stuff just because you think it might impress the client, you know?
Right. Is most of your work mastering now?
Do you know what? I think it's about 50-50, and it has been for the last sort of probably 5 or 10 years, really. But I tend to do a lot of the projects that I'm mixing, I'm also mastering. In fact, I'd say 99% of those projects. And I think that works really well for labels, because I can go in, particularly with projects where they've sort of lost their way a little bit. So they might get to that 80% point and they're like, this shit, this doesn't sound right. What can we do? I can go in and say, you know what? What pot of money is there? I can deliver this to the factory for manufacturing, finished, done, mixed, mastered, for that pot of money. So it's like there's no variables, there's no unknowns, because you know what it's like sometimes when stuff goes to mastering, it can cost twice as much as what they thought.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of those all-in deals where I can just take a problem project that's being nearly finished, and just deliver the right thing for the right budget.
Okay, Mike. So I find this interesting. Would you be mastering as you're mixing?
Okay. Good question, that, because this is something that I don't advise people do, but I do. it took me a while to do this, but what I discovered, and what you'll be obviously aware of as well, is that when you send stuff for mastering, it can often change the balance of the mix.
Mm, yeah.
A classic example of that would be the vocal tends to get pushed into the mix when you add the limiting on. Or what I found, I found that really frustrating when I used to send stuff to get cut. It's like, obviously, and that's why we always used to do vocal up mixes and that type of thing. So what I started doing is, when I was talking about mock masters before, mock mastering or whatever, that would be something that I would put on my mix bus when I'm mixing. Once I get to say, like, once the mix is like 80% there, let's say, I'd start thinking, almost like put a mastering hat on and go, okay, what's likely to happen at mastering? And there would be a limiter involved, usually maybe a little bit of EQ or something. So I would add that to my mix bus so I could start to hear the mix in a mastered way, like a mock mastered way. And so those problems, though, that those changes in the balance that would often happen at mastering, I would already have flagged them while I'm mixing. So straight away, I can push the vocal a bit. I can do any adjustments that the limiter has changed for me. And even if I don't end up mastering the record and I then take that limiter off and send it somewhere, the chances are that those problems won't arise because I've already heard it with the limiter on.
Yeah.
But now what I do is I've been doing that for so long that the two processes, mixing and mastering, and now I just merge them into one. But the danger is that I try not to think about mastering at all until the mix is firing. You know, I want the mix to be 90% there before I go anywhere near a limiter. The danger, as you're aware, is if you start mixing through a limiter, you rely on that limiter then, you know, and if you take it off, the mix falls apart. But what I do is, and it's difficult to do because it's harder. So, you know, we're inherently lazy people. So, you know, you have to work harder to get the mix to sound great without the limiter. So that means when you get to that 90% point and you put it on, it takes it to a whole new level. So I've just got into the habit of doing that now, where I'll hold off with the limiter until the mix is right. And then I'll add the mastering on in the last 10% of the mix and adjust the mix accordingly. You know, I guess if I've got the luxury of time, what I will then do is I'll deliver that for approval. And then maybe in a day or two, I'll go back and I'll just check that the mock mastering is correct. Because sometimes there might be a few little tweaks to do. But it's very rarely much, much different than the final master then.
Okay. Well, that brings up a philosophical question. Most of the major mixers that I know are going to use lots of bus processing.
Yeah.
So the mix they deliver is, for the most part, mastered, that they deliver to mastering.
Yeah.
But most mastering engineers, rightfully so, like some headroom and they like some ability to do stuff. But you know what? Once the artist and the label signs off on it, you can't take any of that bus processing off, or everything is going to sound different, as you know. So where do you stand on that?
Well, the thing is, I like a challenge, you see. So I love this. When mixers deliver stuff that sounds amazing and it's got a limiter on it, I always ask them for one without the limiter. And then I do, like, I basically just battle away until I can better it. And that can take 20 minutes or it can take a couple of hours to do. But I find that there's pretty much 90-odd% of the time I can do something better. But it's not always easy, because as you say, a lot of mixers are delivering really great sounding records with limiting on, and it's almost like you don't want to touch it. But yeah, I think it's worth spending the time to just see if we can get it even better, rather than just presuming that, you know, we won't be able to do anything better than that.
Okay, here's another one for you. What are you delivering? What kind of files are you delivering? Are you delivering a separate streaming master?
Yes. Yeah. So this can be a bit of a minefield, can't it? I mean, I really do wish that the industry would just come up with some sort of standard that all these platforms can tie in with, and it would make our lives so much simpler. But at the moment, we have got a situation where we've got to be careful and consider all the different platforms involved. And sometimes that means delivering a different master for a particular thing. Now, as a core, what I would normally deliver is, I mean, obviously physical format is not as popular now, but if we're doing CD, then there'd be a DDP master for that. And then obviously vinyls become, you know, more popular again now. So I do different vinyl masters with more dynamic range, particularly often different EQ as well, depending on the project really. And then for digital platforms, we'd do a mastered for iTunes file, which would cover all the high definition platforms, so Spotify's, Tidal and all those. And then, you know, there's still a lot of 16-bit platforms out there that can't accept high definition files. So I do a master for those as well. A good example of some other ones that we might do is, for instance, I did a record recently and they put up a little taster of it on Instagram. And Instagram I don't know what they use, their algorithms, but there's a lot of distorted content on there. I don't know if you've noticed, there's a lot of stuff clipping. So I sometimes will deliver, I'll just say, are you doing any Instagram content? If you are, I will do you like a bespoke master for that to make sure that we maximize that without any distortion. SoundCloud, another culprit. You know, sometimes we have to do like minus 4 dB masters for that. I don't know if they might have changed that recently, but at one point it was just sounded terrible, SoundCloud. So yeah, I mean, there's a bit of a handful of files to deliver and to get. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we want projects to sound as good as possible on everything. So if it means spend another 10, 20 minutes pulling some files together to suit that, then great. But the problem I've found is that a lot of particularly the independent distributors, they're a bit lazy, some of them, with what files they're using. So often, even if I send a folder full of well-labeled files, they might just pick out the 16-bit file and use that for everything.
Mm, yeah.
Like, it's not far from ideal, you know. That's out of my hands, unfortunately. So all I can do is present a bunch of files and tell them what they're suitable for, and then I'm at the mercy of the distributor to use it wisely, you know.
You have the same problem to some degree with metadata too.
Exactly, yeah.
If they're in charge of the metadata, you don't know who's going to be doing it. Many times it's the last person hired at a label, so they don't really know anything and they get confused by some of the different formats, what they want, and they just don't fill it in.
Well, this was the beauty of the DDP format, because once it left the mastering house, no one could mess with it.
Yeah.
So it would go to the factory, and then you could guarantee that the CD that you pick up in the shop would be straight off the DDP, no metadata changed, or, you know, so it was pretty bulletproof, really. But now, obviously, with this the whole digital platform thing, it's opened that up again into, as you say, people make mistakes, and it's frustrating. So
let's talk mixing for a second. Are there any plugins that you know you're going to use every mix, no matter what?
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Plugins like this. We are overwhelmed, aren't we, with plugins right now? There's so many great plugins. What I find and what I've always done is, like, once a year, usually first couple of days of January, I have a plugin cull, and I just go through my plugin folder, and anything that I haven't used for a few months just gets put in the unused folder, because it kills your workflow having too many plugins. It's just, you know, at the end of the day, if I want to EQ a kick drum, let's say, for instance, the last thing I want to do is pull up a menu of 50 EQs.
Yeah.
You know, it's just stupid. We used to work on analog consoles with one EQ, you know, for the whole board, and we never complained. We just carried on and mixed records, and, you know, we may have a bit of outboard gear maybe, but generally we used the same EQ for everything and it wasn't a problem. So what I try and do is I have about 10 EQs. I have five that I would call more surgical, and then I would have five sort of that I would call more of like enhancement vibey EQs, and those 10 might change. They might evolve over time, but I try not to have more than that, because it's just unnecessary. And it just means that if I want to EQ that kick drum, it takes me 2 minutes. I'll just go and grab one, EQ it and move on. So I try not to have too many, but I do pick very carefully, and some of the ones that I will be using on everything would be, the Isotope stuff's great. A lot of the, like the Nectar, I love the thing in Nectar where it will track pitch. So I do a lot of notch filtering with monophonic material, stuff like that. It's perfect for that. Soothe, I don't know if you use Soothe. What an incredible plugin that is, amazing. And that's one of the tools that's perfect for that de-harshing thing that I was talking about earlier. Perfect for that. The Sonox stuff I've used for years, really clean, you know, because especially when you start layering plugins, a lot of the time you don't want a plugin to have character, you just want it to do a job. So that Sonox stuff's great for clean, you know, clean work. And obviously the UAD stuff is amazing. I mean, you'll probably see there's not massive amount of outboard gear in here now. This used to be just full of all sorts of stuff, and over the years I just realized I got the UAD stuff and realized actually I wasn't using a lot of the outboard, so that's brilliant for character. The Wave stuff's great. The Plugin Alliance, they've been doing some great work, haven't they, over the last few years.
How about effects?
Effects, okay. I'll tell you, hang on, I've got my computer here, so I'll just Again, the UAD stuff's great for effects, especially the old sort of outboard reverb stuff. You know, the old AMS stuff and all that. But the reverb, I've recently discovered that Seventh Heaven Pro.
Oh, nice! Yeah,
I'm finding it's a Bricasti emulation. So I haven't turned the Bricasti on for a while because I've just been using that, which says a lot because the Bricasti's incredible. Yeah. So that's one of my go-to reverbs now for vocals. What else have we got for reverbs? It's a lot of UAD stuff in here, actually. Particularly like the Capital Chambers.
Oh, my favorite, yeah.
Brilliant, yeah. I'm still using the plate, the EMT 140 plate. What else is there? The Lexicon 480 obviously does a great job. Again, Isotope stuff's great for delays, some really clever delays. Sound Toys stuff is great. I mean, there's so much, so many great plugins. There's a danger of just having too much stuff, and I just find it slows me down. So, I'll try things out when things, new plugins arrive. But I'll usually not add stuff in unless I really need it. You know, I mean, I need another EQ right now, like a hole in the head. I've just got way too many, and I could work forever more with the EQs that I've got now. So, but now and again, something comes up that's clever. And I mean, some of the dynamic EQs, like, I mean, I know Soothe would be in this category. The McDSP AE400 or AE600 or one of those, I use those all the time. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. You know, I mean, mainly stuff that I can't do out of the box. That's where I find plugins are invaluable, you know, things that you just cannot do outside the computer, you know.
Do you have a favorite mixing trick? Is there a technique that you use almost every mix?
I mean, I work 99% of my projects are vocal led. So I'd say, and this isn't really a trick, I'm sure a lot of mixers do this, but for people that are coming into the industry and trying to work out, you know, how to get great mixers, I guess one of my biggest discoveries was to leave the vocal in place all the time. I start with the vocal all the time and get that in the right place, and then everything else just comes afterwards. I start building things around it. But, you know, I try and keep the vocal in like a solo safe state. So that everything I'm working on, whether it's guitars, keys, drums, anything else, the vocal is always there. So, you know, for experienced mixers, that isn't really a trick. I'm sure everyone's doing that. But it was something that I wish someone would have told me earlier on. And you know, that way, and as you're adding things in around the vocal, sometimes you find the vocal's getting lost, and then there's the danger to jump to the vocal and EQ it. And you always have to stop yourself and go, no, hang on a minute. I know that vocal's great. So let's think about why that's happened and go back to what I've just added in and try and sort that out.
You know, in relation to that, whenever I do Q&As, there's inevitably a question about how come my vocal doesn't fit in the mix. When you query, you find out what it is they do put up the whole mix and then put the vocal in at the end. And of course, it's either going to be too loud or too soft. That's never going to fit, you know? So,
So, but I'd say like that, I mean, that would be obvious to a lot of mixers, but to someone coming into the industry, I think I would just wish someone would have told me that like 5 years earlier, you know, it would have saved me a lot of stress.
Yeah. I got it. So COVID hasn't affected you too much because you're doing everything remote anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel really thankful that, you know, this year's been really busy, and we've been doing everything remote, really. I've had a couple of visits from artists, but I'm doing a lot of live stream sessions, so streaming the mix bus to clients, and that's always a fast... But we were doing this anyway, you know, before the COVID thing hit. So nothing's really changed here.
Well, wait, let's come back to that. What are you doing exactly with live streaming?
So we're using, I'm sure there's a lot of your listeners will be using this as well. I was for ages using Nicecast, but it wasn't great. It was like there was quite a delay and it was finicky to use. So I've just switched over to Listen To. It's a company called Audio Movers.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
So And I think I'm pretty sure there's a couple of other companies doing this now, because there's the technology's there where you can get the latency right down to, you know, 0.3 of a second or something. So when I press play on the desk, it's streaming straight away to the client. And, you know, years ago, before we were doing this, we'd have an email with a list of things saying, oh, can you turn the snare up? Can you turn the guitar down or whatever? And it's like, well, how much do I turn the snare down? How much? Like, and then, so you do a version and they might go, oh, you've turned it down too much. And can you take it back up again? And so 100 emails later, you get there in the end. But with a streaming session, it's so much quicker, because they can say, okay, can you turn the snare down? I'd be like, well, have a listen to this. What do you think of that? Okay, too much. Yeah, back up, done.
Okay, I see. When you're talking live streaming, I thought you were somehow feeding Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or something like that. But this is just client, between you and a client.
These are private streaming sessions, yeah. Sorry, yeah, I should have explained.
Last question. What is the best piece of business advice that either someone imparted to you or maybe you learned along the way?
Quality control. Now, I'll explain that, because that doesn't mean much, me just saying that. But what I found is that you're only as good as your last job. So what I try and do, and what I've always tried to do, I realized this very early on in my career, just listening to other producers that I was assisting, is that, you know, you deliver one crappy job and the phone stops ringing. So you've got to keep that quality control up. And the way that I try and do that is I try and approach every single job as if it's going to be the best record that I've ever made. And often that, obviously that's not always going to happen, but if you approach it in that way, the chances are you're going to deliver something great. And if I look back now over my whole career, the reason why I've kept busy, I mean, there may be a little bit of luck involved, but I think you make your own luck. And I think I've basically kept clients happy, just delivered what they want. And it's not always easy, but I've made sure that, you know, I've delivered quality work over and over again. And people keep calling you back and people tell their friends. And I don't think there's any other way to do it. I really don't. So I think really what, I guess the key thing is to be careful what you say yes to, because some projects you're probably not the best producer or the best mixer for. Some projects, you know, if I'm trying to mix a project that hasn't been produced well, or the song's no good, or the performances are poor, chances are my mix isn't going to be great. So it's like, do I really want to do that project and put my name on it? So even though it's really difficult to say no sometimes to projects, I think that it's really important to just make sure that whatever you're agreeing to get involved with, you can deliver something amazing. And I'm fairly confident that that's what's kept me busy. Just being very cautious about making sure that I can deliver something amazing on every job. I wish it wasn't like that in a way. I wish that it was as easy as just, you know, waking up in the morning, having fun in the studio and going home and everyone's happy, but it doesn't always work like that, does it? But that's just the only way that I've found that works, you know?
Yeah.
It also as well, I think like I always feel like I'm still trying to prove myself, even though I've delivered some big records and stuff over time, and it's like it never stops, that thing of having to prove myself all the time. So I accept it now. It's fine. It's no big deal. But it's just something to be aware of, is that it never stops. You don't get to a point and you go, oh, I'm fine now. I can relax.
You can find out more about Mike at mikecave.co.uk. That's Mike Cave, C-A-V-E, all one word, mikecave.co.uk. You can also find out about Loft Mastering at loftmastering.com. Loft Mastering, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.